Well, maybe it was just as fitting that I forgot some music there. Because what if Jesus had never been born? There probably wouldn't be much music to be even in this world. This is kind of a disjointed series because I started one here, one there. But I'm continuing this series based on the book by Dr. James Kennedy, who used to be right up the road here. Wrote a couple books, which I like. This one, What If Jesus Never Been Born? What the world would be like? What kind of world would we have? We wouldn't have a story to tell if we didn't have Jesus. And we wouldn't be a wonderful story to tell to sing about as well. As we've seen that Christianity to the world has contributed several ways. First one we saw was it contributed to an increase in value of human life. It has promoted for the care of the poor and the sick. It contributed to the development of good government, civil and religious rights, and contributed to science and education. The foundations of science and education, many of the people who developed it were all Christians, and believers in some sense of God in the Bible. Last time we looked at Christianity's contribution to economics and the work ethic, and we found and showed that there that where Christianity has advanced in the world, generally speaking, economic prosperity followed. Now we saw in that basically there's two types of economic systems. There is capitalism, which is called, or free market capitalism, which is based on the idea of people have the right to private property. Then there's socialism or market controlled capitalism, which says there's no private property, that everything belongs to everyone, or the collective. And then there are variations of these two types of economic systems, which we called interventionism, or sometimes I could have gone in more elaborate last time, talking about crony capitalism, in which governments get involved somehow and intervene in the free market system because they think that they know better and how to deal with it. Now, one thing I wanted to mention last time, but I didn't, was how do Christians then deal with economic inequalities? You know, it's often a campaign issue that certain people don't have enough money, or women don't get paid the same amount as men, and so there's inequalities in sex and race and so forth. Well, how do Christians then deal with this? Well, or some people say, well, taxation, which is forced theft. Basically, so we're going to not just take the money in order to pay for general purposes like roads and everything, but we're just going to tax people so that we can pretend like we're going to take it from take from the rich and give it to the poor. And so or wealth redistribution. So they think, well, we have what they call sometimes social justice. Now it's going to, then another way, I think the biblical way, is voluntary grace giving. And I was going to read this paper, which I forgot to bring it, in which Charlie Bing talks about thoughts on socialism, equality, and need. And he quotes this verse, I've read this verse too, 2 Corinthians 8, 13 and 14, where it says, Paul says, "For I do not mean that others should be at ease or burdened, but by an inequality, that now at this time your abundance may supply their lack. Their abundance may also supply your lack, that there may be equality." So Paul was talking about, he saw, went throughout the different churches throughout Asia Minor, Turkey, modern-day Turkey, and in Greece and so forth. He saw there was a disparity of inequality of physical needs. Some churches had much and some churches had little. So he saw there was an inequality. What was his solution to that? Well, his was voluntary grace giving, voluntarily helping other Christians. And Charlie Bing talked about how, in fact, one time he was goes overseas, and one day he reached in his pocket and he gave some what he thought was pocket change to a pastor that was there. And the pastor, oh, thank you. You know that was 2 months worth of wages to that pastor in this situation. So we see that there's inequalities in the world today. So as believers here in the nation of abundance, we have a responsibility to help, especially believers and so forth. And he talked about in that passage about if you have like Christian magazines or books that you're not using, you can donate those, and then they can send them overseas, and they'll take that and then pass them all around. So there's ways in which we can assist the poor. We've been talking about that in James too. So what if Jesus had never been born? The world economically would have been a much poorer place. Today we're going to be looking at Christianity's contribution to art and music. We have a little art or music appreciation day here. This is, like I said before, this is if you were going to Miami Christian College or you're going to Dallas Seminary or something, this will be a course in what they call apologetics. Apologetics is the Greek word to defend. People, if you're going out and share the gospel with someone, they're going to have objections and say, well, you know, I remember the church was against, they're against art, and they went and destroyed churches and so forth during the Reformation. Well, so the church is against art and music. Not true. We're going to see that. That, in fact, Christianity helped provide the foundation and the growth of both art and music. First, let's look at art, the famous painting there, Mona Lisa. First of all, back in the Old Testament, we saw that God used, Moses used, God directed Moses to use gifted artisans, craftsmen, to build the ark. He said, told Moses, then Moses called Beelzebul and Abelah and every gifted artisan in whose heart the Lord had put wisdom and capability of great craftsmanship. Everyone whose heart was stirred to come and do the work in building the ark. The Old Testament and the New Testament, if you think about it, provides art with some of its greatest subjects. Artwork that's been created. The parting of the Red Sea, or Jesus talking to the woman at the well, a couple samples. We saw that the Jews themselves did not create a lot of art because of the second commandment. You shall not make for yourselves graven image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You know, they had a huge problem throughout their whole history of idolatry, basically not keeping this commandment. They would create all sorts of idols and so forth. And then after the Babylonian captivity, they kept away from that, at least making false images, all right? And so they may have taken it to an extreme, so they didn't make any images, okay, at all, okay? However, Richard Mulliger, an art museum curator and author, said that the advent of Christianity, though, brought forth the desire to match words with images, and since then the texts of the Old Testament have held a place in art equal to those of the Gospels and the Epistles. James Kennedy then quotes this in his book, if Jesus then had never been born, there would be no art from the Old Testament as well as from the New. A author by the name of Cynthia Pearl Maas, in a book she wrote called Christ and the Fine Arts, says this: more poems have been written, more stories, old pictures, or more pictures painted, more songs sung by Christ than any other person in human history, because through such avenues as these, the deepest appreciation of the human heart can be more equally expressed. Now, through the first 3 centuries of Christianity, there was actually little art to be found. If there was art, they were mostly found in the catacombs, the burial places that the Christians created, and underground and so forth. For the most part, Christianity was just surviving, trying to survive. It wasn't a legal religion. It wasn't that they could have open churches and create and had time for art and music. But during the Byzantine period, which is basically from about 300, 350 up until about the first millennium, art began to flourish, and we see some examples of some of that Byzantine art. And an example of one of those churches is this church, Hagia Sophia, which is now today in modern Istanbul, and that's what it looks like today. Of course, the Muslims turned this church into a mosque, and that's why you see the little pinnacle things on the sides. But some believe that this is what it originally looked like. And this is a church 1,500 years old, so it's very old. But it was originally a church that was built during what they call the Byzantine period. And this is what it looks like inside. You can see some of the Islamic symbols in there. And originally there were Christian paintings in there. And they, of course, they painted over most of that. And in Islam, they have they push the second commandment to an extreme where they don't have any type of images, or you're not going to see pictures of Muhammad or whatever in their mosques and so forth, because they don't want people to be worshiping the Muhammad. Okay. Then there was the Romanesque period, which was characterized by semi-circular arches. And churches began to become more elaborate and so forth, more better architectural construction techniques were taking place. And here's an example of one of these churches. Then there was the Gothic period. Sometimes they break it up into pre-Gothic, Gothic, and post-Gothic. And this period goes from basically, depending on the art experts, goes from about 800 BC AD up until about the 13th century or so forth. And here's a church where the cathedrals became more elaborate and even more beautiful. So Christianity was creating art, and they were creating it primarily through the cathedrals and so forth. There was a cathedral by Louis the VI of France, who just built one of the churches, I believe it was probably in Paris, and he created it so that people would come and wonder in awe. It was an attraction. It was like the Disney World. People would come from all over just to see this church and other churches that were being built. Of course, the most famous of the Gothic period is the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, France. Anyone's ever been there? Okay, so pretty elaborate. It's famously known for the flying buttresses. All right, new architectural structure, and then you can see the interior of it. Just magnificent structures, and of course they designed these churches to elevate and get you thinking about God looking upward toward God, so that these churches themselves communicated visually the splendor and grandeur of God. That was the purpose for why they would build these great structures and so forth. Then there came the Renaissance period, known as the Golden Age of Art. And we see throughout the Renaissance period there were not all Renaissance painters were Christian. They were everyone was a Christian, at least in the small C sense, because if you weren't, you're probably thrown in prison, all right? So many of those paintings and art was biblical themes were among the most prominent works, and we see Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper there. Michelangelo, one of the greatest of the Renaissance artists, created great statues. I had a little replica of one of those statues at my home that my grandmother, she went on a lot of trips, and she would come back from Rome or wherever she was, and had little ivory or marble statues. And I had the one on the right there of Jesus dead in the arms of Mary. Then there's the famous statue of David. Now, we were at the museum in London, and in London they had this statue among other statues in the museums there in London, but they were replicas. They weren't the original one. But to me, it was like, man, this is like, wow. This was like, I couldn't tell the difference. Anyway, these were magnificent pieces of art and created out of stone. Of course, Michelangelo's always made famous for the Sistine Chapel, which he painted on the roof of the church. Let's hope we have a good roof that's going to keep the rain out. All right. He also supervised the construction of the dome at St. Peter's Church in Rome. And then there was Raphael, who painted on many Christian themes, as you see here, as well. Then there was Leonardo da Vinci, who created some of the greatest works of art inspired by Christ. Now, I'm going to notice here that Da Vinci, that's not his last name. His name is Leonardo. That's it. He didn't have a last name. He's Leonardo from Vinci, from the town of Vinci. So the guy who wrote the Da Vinci Code, he didn't know what he's talking about. It should have been called the Leonardo Code, not the From Vinci Code. What's that mean? Anyway, Leonardo da Vinci, again, created many famous paintings during this period. And then there was one of my favorites, Rembrandt. And you see, he also painted many Christian themes, a dedicated believer. We see on the left a painting of Belshazzar's feast when Babylon was about to be overtaken, and the famous picture of Jesus in the boat in the storm of the Galilee. Also, Rembrandt, like I said, was a devout Christian. He even painted himself into one of the pictures there. You see there, right over here, this little guy looking up, that's Rembrandt himself at the cross of Jesus. So we see that the Christian's religion has provided the greatest themes for the greatest art. All right, so we've seen how Christianity has contributed to art. Let's look now how Christianity contributed to the development of music. I would say that Christianity is really the source of what I call real music. You ever think about other kinds of religious music? Eastern versus Western type music. You ever heard of Chinese music or American Indian music or music from India and other places? Their music is undescript. It's what they call monophonic versus polyphonic. Mono meaning one, just one level, right? Like in the Boy Scouts, they have sometimes Indian chants, and they go, hey, 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 but have the drum, boom, boom, boom. Hey, 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 and just the same thing over and over and over and over again. There's no real descriptive beginning, middle, or end. It's just the same thing over and over again, right? Same thing in Chinese music. I got a neighbor of mine plays he's from Barbados or something, and he plays some Indian music, and it's just kind of weird. All right, so which means that there's no variation in tone, pitch. It's just a constant beat or of some sort. Versus in Western music, real music, there are variations in pitch and in tone and in rhythm and so forth. All right. Music as we know it in the Western world is largely the product of the church or Christians in the church. All right, let's look. The Old Testament was the foundation of music. We saw that the early church found its roots in the Jewish temple. I was going to quote it. There's a verse there in 2 Chronicles and in Samuel. It talks about when they were dedicating the temple, Solomon built a temple. They talked about how they were playing musical instruments and singing and so forth, the great celebration. So they laid the foundation for music. Of course, we all know about David playing the harp, and he wrote many psalms, right? There's an entire book in the Bible dedicated to songs and psalms, right? All right? Jesus and his disciples sang from the psalms after the Lord's, the Last Supper. They sang a song and departed. So they were singing songs. Now, during the classical period, Pope Gregory the First, around, I don't know, 400 or 500 A.D., created what was known as the Gregorian chant. And this was more monophonic. It was a very basic type of singing. And he assigned particular liturgy to various services throughout the year and wrote new melodies. You've heard of the Gregorian calendar, okay? You would sing certain songs for certain times of the year. And that basically was much of the type of music that was played throughout the early years in the Middle Ages, early Middle Ages. But during the Middle Ages, there was this man by the name of Gildo El Zero, right? He is known as the father of musical notation. You know, the famous Do, Re, Mi, Fa, La, Ti, Do. What's that? Pitches. All right. He created this, the note system, right? Which was basically kind of like a written language for music, or as language is to literature. All right. Then during the Middle Ages, the Notre Dame choir master, created the motet, which was a four-part harmony, which we get the soprano, the alto, the tenor, and the bassist. So there were the choirs. They were different. People would sing based on their abilities. All right. The men bass, the women sopranos. Pitch, added pitch and variation. So this was the beginning of polyphonic or multi-part music. All right. Then during the Renaissance, music became more independent of words and the use of instruments became more widespread throughout the Renaissance period. During the Reformation, which was part of the Renaissance, so to speak, Martin Luther himself composed music and played the lute. We sing one of his songs, How Great a Foundation, right? And the lute was that little guitar thing that he's playing there. And another thing that he created was that he wanted to teach the illiterate masses in Germany basic doctrine he did through music. And he did that by introducing congregational singing by using chorals and hymns. Do you remember that before that time, people in the out in the pews here in the congregation did not sing at church? They came and they listened, but they didn't participate. It was Martin Luther, one of the ones who began to introduce such an idea. All right. Now, during the Baroque period, which is post-Reformation, talking 17th, 18th century, we have one of the two most famous musicians of the day who contributed greatly to the development of music. There was Johann Sebastian Bach. Let's first look at him. He's known as the father of modern music. Why? Because he developed what's called the fugue, the contrapuntal music, or in other words, two or more independent melodies, that is major and minor lines. If you know anything about music, there's the treble clef and the bass clef, right? So he created two different opposing or a complementary ways of joining music, all right? This was the base of concertos, sonatas, quartets, symphonies were all able to develop because of his technique. Of course, Bach dedicated every single note to the glory of God, he said. If you looked at his original scores and so forth, he would write on there, to the glory of God. Then we had Handel, who's most notably known for, of course, the Messiah, and he felt that he was under divine inspiration as he composed this cantata, I guess you would call it. All right, so we've seen that Christianity has contributed to music, and the culmination and climax of the Baroque era of music laid the foundation for all music that followed. The critical point here to remember is that the foundation for Western music and its subsequent development was laid by the Christian Church. Despite whatever, how the music has gone in whatever directions today, the foundation of music was laid by the Church. So we've seen how Christianity contributed to art and music. However, we've seen a loss, a degradation of artistic construction, I guess you could say. The art and the loss of meaning. And it began in what was during the early Renaissance period, known as the Impressionism. And you can see from the previous photos that I showed you, or paintings from Rembrandt and so forth, that humans looked like humans. They were almost like photographs. They pictured people as being created in the image of God, and therefore they had worth and they had meaning. But as many people, intellectuals and artists and so forth, began to wander from God and take God out of the picture, life began become blurry. All right. So you can see in these paintings the Impressionism. The one on the left, we have people kind of like almost cartoon-type characters. And then the picture begins to get real fuzzy in the middle. And you have Van Gogh's painting of these flowers. I think I remember seeing that, and they had it on tour, borrowed at the Philadelphia Museum once. I remember seeing a famous Van Gogh painting. I think that was the one I saw. Now you get into what's called Expressionism, where life, as people moved more further and further away from God in philosophy and in music and in art, we see a degradation of the art, which then life becomes very dark and disturbing, right? Then we get into what's called Picasso Cubism, where you can't make any particular meaning out of anything that's being painted, right? It's very bizarre, right? And there are other ones that are even more bizarre than this, right? And if you go down to Miami, the Wynwood, right? You can see some of this. That's what I call where modern art comes together with graffiti. They combine themselves. And then they have what's called the Art Basel Art Festival. And if you were to the Miami Art Basel Art Festival, you would see all sorts of this bizarre, obscure art. In fact, I was there covering it one time, and I go in, and there's all this strange, what they consider art. And then there was a guy who was playing what they call Basel or modern art music, which is basically just a bunch of sounds. It was worse than Eastern music. It was just Just a bunch of random chance sounds. And that's the degradation of art because of God being removed from our world. Now, Forrest Gump. Everyone's seen the movie Forrest Gump? All right. Some people, this is their favorite movie, right? Forrest Gump is a illustration of existentialism. And what is existentialism? That's a kind of a big word. It basically means that in the movie, it's illustrated in Forrest Gump by Forrest running. Run, Forrest, run. He's running. In the movie, he starts running. All right? And all these bizarre things throughout his whole life happen to him. Right? And he's running, and he's running along, and some guy comes up, "Hey, you just stepped in it." You know? He just stepped in it. And he goes, "Yeah, it happens." I'll try to be polite here. It happens, right? And then the bumper stickers go around. It happens, right? And he's running, and some come up, "Why are you, Forrest, why are you running? Why are you running?" "Oh, I don't know. I don't know why I'm running. I'm just running." Why? Because in existentialism has people left God out of their life. They don't see any rhyme or reason to what's going on. Why is this happening? It just happens, you know? And so there's no meaning to it. Oh, I got a few more minutes here, I think. I want to play a little clip over here by, in this film called Grasping for the Wind by John Whitehead. He heads the Rutherford Institute, and he's a lawyer, and he helps defend people for religious freedom. Let me see if I can get this going here as I switch the source here for a second. All right. It talks about the art and the loss of meaning.
Long before our turbulent century began, the seeds of modern chaos were sown. The ideas that have shaped our present world were first gradually developed in the minds of philosophers and later popularized through the works of artists and entertainers. An overall summary of man's search for meaning in the modern era can be seen through an investigation of three very different works of art. Rembrandt's Adoration of the Shepherds, which he painted in 1646, God by Morton Schomburg, completed in 1917, and Three Studies for Figures at the Base of the Crucifixion, painted in 1944 by Francis Bacon.
These three works dramatically illustrate that the way many artists, intellectuals, and others in the 20th century perceive human beings has radically changed. As we can see, Rembrandt's Adoration of the Shepherds is about the story of Jesus Christ's birth. Virtually all classical works of art illustrate the same point Rembrandt's painting makes. Life has meaning because human beings are created with a divine purpose. This message undergirds almost all of Western art up to the modern age.
In contrast to Rembrandt and the artists of the past, we find a very different message in the art of the 20th century. As an example of how far we have moved from the Judeo-Christian world of belief, let's look in more detail at this work of art. Morton Schomburg's sculpture, God, which stands here at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, is a pivotal illustration of how far Western culture has moved from its original base.
sculpture shows us that the god worshipped by Rembrandt and his society had been replaced by Schomburg with a god that is only a disconnected and impersonal concept, represented by a twisted and disconnected piece of plumber's pipe. Schomburg's god is removed and unrelated to humanity, and thus can have no personal influence on mankind or on mankind's society, or provide any intrinsic worth to people. Francis Bacon's three studies for figures at the base of a crucifixion illustrates a stark difference in viewpoint from that of artists such as Rembrandt. Completed during World War II, this painting depicts modern man's sense of isolation. Three studies can be interpreted as depicting people alone, disconnected not only from God, but also from fellow human beings.
How have we come to the point of despair? How have we moved from the moral certainty depicted by Rembrandt to the chaos of uncertainty found in modern art? The answer is that we have changed our ideas about the meaning of life.
And he goes on in that video to explain all of that, how we've moved from a world where art and music were real and meaningful, distinctive, to a world where life is confusing, dark, and so forth. But how can we return? Well, we have to return to God. So, what if Jesus had never been born? Well, the world would be a much uglier place. It would be a place that would be much less beautiful. But we can still, as believers, keep our faith in God and create, give out the message of life to a dark and confused world.